Today is July 22nd, 2008. My name is Garrett Blava, and today I will be interviewing Mr. Leo McCracken about some of his military experiences. Mr. McCracken was a member of the 128th Field Artillery, which was a part of the 6th Armored Division during World War II. To begin with, Mr. McCracken, I'd like to start by asking you a little bit about your background. Where and when were you born?
October 30th, 1922.
Okay. And you were from
Youngstown, Ohio.
Youngstown, Ohio? Okay.
Yes.
What did your parents do?
My father's a lawyer.
Okay.
My mother was a housewife, I guess you'd say.
And what was your early life like in Youngstown? What activities were you involved in? What did you like to do?
Play baseball.
Okay.
I hated school.
You attended school in Youngstown?
Yes.
Okay. And you would have been graduating around 1942, is that when you...
That's correct.
And so then right after school... You went right into the military?
That's correct. In November. Graduated in June.
And what prompted you to join the military?
Draft.
Okay. And did you sign? Were you immediately drafted or was there any waiting period there?
From the time of graduation until I was drafted was what? 4 months, 5 months.
And did you pretty much know when you graduated that you were going to?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Do you remember where you were when Pearl Harbor was attacked?
No. Well, at home.
But you had a feeling while you were getting through school that when you were out, the war was on by the time you were out, so there was going to be military service.
Yeah, pretty much, yes. I would say so.
Did you have any say in what branch of service you went into, or were you sure you were going to go into the Army? Or?
No. I had no say.
And... Usually
when you're drafted, you went in the Army, period.
Mm-hmm.
You had to volunteer for Marines. I did volunteer for that, and due to my teeth, they wouldn't take me.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately for me, probably, in retrospect.
That would have, Pacific Theater. It
would have been a coup de grace for me.
Mm-hmm. And what would have been the experience, or what was the experience like once you were notified that you were being drafted? Where did you have to go, and what did you have to do then?
Well, went down in Youngstown to get examined, and then I was inducted into the Army in Akron.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I went in November, I was shipped to Columbus.
Would that have been Fort Hays or?
Fort Hays, mm-hmm. Exactly. And I was there for like 3 days, and I shipped out of there, and I kept saying, geez, I wish I could go to California. I just never had been there. They didn't tell you when you're going when you got on the train. But the rumor got around. They talked to the conductors and the railroad people, guys that worked in the railroad. We got the rumor that we were headed for California. So that's where I went.
And was that where you did basic training?
Yep.
What was basic training like? Around how long was it?
Basic training is, 6 weeks? Don't remember for sure anymore. That's
okay.
That's 63, 4 mm-hmm. years ago. Yeah.
Do you know what kind of what would a typical day be like? Do you remember if you woke up very early or?
Oh yes. Yes. Yeah. I'd get up at the sergeant and come through the barracks and everybody out. Not what get up 6 o'clock maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Went and had calisthenics, then breakfast, then. Whatever they wanted to do, going to, we had like the morning would be instruction in class, like, and then as soon as you got done there, you go out and have hands on,
mm-hmm.
whether it's machine gun or whatever. They teach you how to disassemble a M1 and all that stuff. You know.
Mm-hmm. And
marching.
Did they notify you at any point then? What service what part of the service you would go into, armor or infantry, or when was that decided?
I was already in the, when I got sent to California, it was the 13th Armored Division, so I knew I was in.
So they already had decided you were.
That was it, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
And did you have any advanced training for the armor, or what did they do after that?
No, usually when you go in the Army, if you're a cook, they'll make a tank gunner out of your in civilian life, if you repaired guns, they'd make a cook out of you. That's the Army.
So
that's not making that up.
Okay. And were you assigned for specialized training? You eventually went into the field artillery. Did they already decide you were going to be in the artillery at that point?
That's a long story, but okay. I'll try to shorten it. When I went in, I was in reconnaissance in the 13th Army. Mm-hmm. And I liked that. But when they first organized the armored divisions, they had like 15,000 men in them, okay, in each division. And in 1943, they decided to cut down the division to like 11,000 men. So I was a sergeant at that time. And I was didn't have a room in a TO, table organization, all right? So about, I don't remember how many, it was quite a few of us, all sergeants or better. They have a job for us. So they sent us down they'd have to send them out to different other organizations in the Army. Some of them went to infantry, some of them went, they sent me to an amphibious tank battalion. Mm-hmm. That's where the alligators, where they on the water with the tracks and stuff. Mm-hmm. Marines used them a lot. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like that outfit. I don't mind the water. I can swim like a duck. Where we live in Ohio, we had a pond in the backyard. It's about 2 acres. So we skated and I learned to swim about as quick as I could walk. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like that amphibious tank battalion. So the guy said, hey, you go in, ask for a request. And the captain, he's been transferring guys out. So I went in, I went through the whole bit, you know, certain blah, blah, blah. I said, I request a transfer, da, da, da. Mm-hmm. Which, a couple of days, my name was on the board, and they sent me to the 6th Armored Division. That's how I ended up. And then there, they didn't assign me to any outfit, any part of the division at that time. We had an unbelievable barracks full of sergeants. It was like that for about 3 weeks. Unbelievable for the Army. I mean, all we were attached was room, quarters and board, meals and quarters. Mm-hmm. We'd get passes whenever we want, but couldn't go too many. I couldn't, but yeah, didn't have the money. But then that's when they eventually assigned to the 128th Armored Field Artillery. Well, I told you, it's kind of a roundabout story, but that's the way it
was. Did they need sergeants there, or what was it like getting into that unit?
They didn't need sergeants, but they had a full thing. So I was assigned as a cannoneer or ammo loader.
What was it like? Had that unit had been a National Guard unit, so were those people all in that unit from the start, or were you considered an outsider, or what was the relationship
like? I would be considered an outsider, yes.
And was there any
But there were other ones in there also. Mm-hmm. You know, our gunner is from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He wasn't from St. Louis, but our tank commander, he's one of the original National Guard. St. Louis, nice guy too, but no, it was mixed up.
Was there
a tank driver? He was the driver. He's from the original.
Had they had a lot of experience before the war training? Was this a fairly experienced outfit?
Yes, yeah. They would train before they ever really, you know, got into it. Maybe not necessarily the 6th Armored, but they knew field artillery, you know. Mm-hmm. They were trained for that before the war, before they went in the final.
And what kind of training did you do with them?
We practiced firing and so forth.
And this was all in California?
Yes. I was in Camp Beale, which is Northern California, originally, 13th Armored. The 6th Armored is down around Santa Barbara at Camp Cook, which is, 200-300 miles away, mm-hmm. or more. Down below San Francisco. So, we trained in California.
Did you have any sense when you were there? Where did you think you'd be sent out to the Pacific, or did you know that you were going to go to Europe, or no idea?
Well, we probably pretty well knew we were going to go to Europe, because they didn't use armored divisions in the Pacific. Okay. They used armor, but not armored divisions that I know of. All the armored divisions went to Europe. Because mm-hmm. the Nazis are the ones that had the Germans had the armor and the Panzers meaning tanks.
And just to get a sense of this would have been most of 1943 when you were in California?
Correct.
And when did you find out that you were going to Europe? When did they notify you, or how did they notify you?
We heard rumors, and that was very short notice. In October, I think it was. They started giving each soldier these heavy duffel bags and so forth. And we had to stamp our name on them and serial number, all that stuff. So we knew something was up. But they don't really tell you until the last minute, you know. Mm-hmm. So, but in October, we knew something was up.
And then you took trains back from California to...
That's right.
Where did you leave from? Where did you leave the United States from?
New York.
Okay. And then the whole division was on, or the whole... You were on one ship, or how many people would have been on the ship?
The whole division couldn't go on one ship. Mm-hmm. But the 128 Armored Field Artillery was on the Henrique.
Okay.
And they'd have different ships. And... as I wrote in my thing, that was the largest convoy to cross the Atlantic up to that time. And the seas were so rough, they said, the roughest it had been in 25 years, and it's true.
Yeah, I know that you wrote that after the Statue of Liberty, you weren't well until you got to England.
I was sick, man. And I ate crackers and all that. That's a lot of crap, man. It doesn't work.
And it took
sick. They said even the captain was seasick.
Wow.
The sailors told us.
And it took about 10 days, or how long did it take to get across?
Yeah, I think it was 10 days, or 10 or 11.
Okay.
But we were, you know, zigzagging.
And since you were sick, you weren't doing much on the ship. You were
just trying... Well, a lot of times they wouldn't let us up on it. It was so bad, you'd go up, you'd see the front of that thing go, and the back. I'm sounding like I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. It was, you can't believe, like 40-foot waves and stuff like that.
What type of ship was it? Like how big?
Liberty ship.
Okay, so it wasn't extremely big. It was...
No, that was like a cork in a maelstrom. I don't know the dimensions of it. You can check that, but I don't know. Okay. Wasn't big. Wasn't the Queen Mary. Some of the guys went to Queen Mary, but boy, I didn't.
And then once you arrived, what happened when you got to England?
What did we arrive in? Was it Glasgow or Edinburgh? Firth of Forth, I think. Where is that?
Would have been
Firth of Forth. At Edinburgh.
I'm not sure.
It doesn't matter. That's where we landed anyway. And then we went by train and traveled down through Scotland, down through England too.
Did they give you any chance to get better in Scotland, or were you immediately put on the train?
Oh, I don't remember. Not too long ago.
Okay.
Besides, I know one thing. When I got off that ship, I don't. They didn't give you time. You from seasickness, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think they consider that. But anyway, I know I wobbled for about 2 days. You know, like, you know, you heard of that about sailors? You know, they get off. Yep. Well, it's true. But we went down by took us by train down to. Stone Wool, that's where we stayed, in England.
And then what kind of training did you do there? Did you have a better...
More the same. We had our M7 there, and we went out on firing missions, and they sent us up to Ingsley Island. Does that sound right?
I'm not sure.
Up in the mid part of England, the Midlands, for firing at the anti-aircraft, because we had a .50 caliber on the tank. And, the plane would pull a pylon back. Some of the times they'd say, watch for your street, they'd shot a hole in the plane, some of the guys. I'm serious. Sometimes they shoot a cable in two with a lucky shot, but yeah, some of the planes had holes in them.
So you were anticipating, they were at least trying to prepare you for a possible fighter attack or
something. We had a lot of that.
Okay.
I'm not taking anything about the guy away from the guys in Iraq, but if they had the firepower thrown at them that we did every day, yeah, you'd have 100,000 dead over there now. I'm serious. The big killer of is artillery. They don't have that problem. They have mortars, yeah, we had mortars too, but artillery causes 60% of the casualties. They don't have any, especially those 88s. Muzzle velocity's over 3,000 feet per second. Well, I said you don't have time to pray on those.
Did you have any knowledge of what the German firepower would be when you were in England? Did they have any preparation that prepared you for the problems you faced?
They told us we had the best equipment, the best guns, the best everything in the world, which we found out was a bunch of crap. Didn't take us long. Not true. Our tanks weren't near as good as the Germans. Not near. Our medium tank, Sherman tanks, with the muzzle velocity was what, 1,400 feet per second or something like that. Mm-hmm. Germans was over twice that. The barrel on ours was like 12 feet long. Their 88 or 75 millimeters, whichever was tank was mounted on, the Panther, the Tigers had 88s on them, I think it was. But their muzzle velocity was 3,000, almost twice what ours was. They could shoot from here to Butler Plaza accurately. Yeah. No, they in England, because we had the best of everything, which was not true.
And you were in, it was an M7, correct? And how would you describe that tank to someone who might not be familiar with it?
It's a medium, it's like a Sherman tank, but instead of a 75 millimeter main gun on it, we had a 105 millimeter howitzer, which is 4 inches, basically.
And you, and how many crew would you have on that?
About 7. The medium tank had 5.
And were you with the same 7 people pretty much for the entire, at least through training, was it the same 7 people?
Yes.
And was this a situation like the Army Air Corps, where the tank would be named, or?
Yes, the name of ours was Alert. But I didn't have anything to do with the name, you know, the tank commander, I guess, named it, I think, Bill Adamat, or I guess he had to do with the naming of it. Not me, because that was already done by the time I joined the 6th Army.
And I've read that the M7 was called, it was nicknamed something like the Priest, is
that's correct.
And so
that's due to the fact that the right hand, where the 50 caliber machine gun was mounted, it swiveled around a track 360 degrees and it looked like a pulpit. That's what got that name.
And you would be primarily used as artillery support for something, is that correct?
Close support. Yeah, we could be going down the road and we'd pull off right off the road, just like you're going down Archer Road and get a fire mission in Archer. You just pull off the road and set up your aiming stake and get your direction properly. And
what would be the accuracy of the gun? How far could it fire?
7 miles max.
And that's the effective range too, that you could, you're pretty accurate from that distance. Yeah.
But that accurate only because of a forward observer out there, mm-hmm. of which I was part of for about 3 months. Lieutenant Hansman and I, we were right with the infantry. We directed the firepower where they're to shoot. One short, one over, the next one on. Look out. They take one gun to zero it in. And then it wasn't necessarily the same tank all the time. Then once they were on it, they'd call for fire for effect and the whole battery would fire.
And what would be a well-trained crew, what could you expect in terms of how many shells could you fire in a specific time? Or would you even be trying to do that? Or would you be trying to coordinate to find out as much as the forward observer calls for? Is that how it would be done? Or
that's correct. The forward observer is the one that actually directs the fire.
So there'd be no case where you're just firing as much as you can. It would always be directed by a specific...
No, it only depends on the situation. Mm-hmm. If you have an infantry attack, a bunch of crowds attacking, as long as they keep attacking, you're going to keep firing. If it slacks off, why? Probably we slack off.
And of course,
depends on the situation.
And you could be 5 to 7 miles away where you're not going to know if the attack's slacking off or not. So
you're up there on the front. That's right. No, people firing the gun wouldn't know. No, they're on a phone. I mean, yeah, they ran wire. First thing they get in position, they run wire. And you're on a phone and you get your firing orders from the headquarters battery. They direct the fire to each, actually, right down to each gun.
And sort of going back to your time in England, what kind of relationship did you have with other branches of the army? Did you work at all with infantry, or did you work at all with any of the British troops that were in England at that time?
No.
So you were just doing drills with your unit?
That's right. No.
And did you kind of get a sense that the invasion was going to happen soon, or what was it like?
Well, we knew it was. That's why we were there. But we didn't know when. It was very secretive.
And when did you find out? Did you know on June 6th that it was happening, or when did you find out?
We knew, because I remember when you read my writings, we saw all these planes going over. It's endless. Someone towing gliders, so we knew that was it. It doesn't take a rocket science to figure that out.
And then once this starts, what was the situation like for you? Were you preparing to move at a moment's notice, or?
No. No, we weren't. We weren't supposed to be in on D-Day. Patton hadn't started his army yet, okay? Mm-hmm. We didn't know it at the time, but we were to be part of his army, Third Army. And we didn't know when we were going to France. We were going to go, but we didn't know when.
What was the situation like for you? Do you remember what you were feeling? Were you uneasy, or what kind of things would be going through your head as you're sort of waiting there?
Well, I can't remember. That's a long time ago, but I'm sure I was uneasy. We knew what we were going to face.
And then you found out a few weeks later that you were... How did you find out that you were going over?
Well, they just gave us orders that we took got in our tank and we went right down. We left Stone and Wall and went right on down to Southampton. They let us on LSTs and we drove the tank right on there.
And then how long did it take for you to cross the channel at that point?
Well, I can't tell you exactly. It wasn't long. The channel isn't wide there, right? I can't tell you that. Maybe, I don't know.
Do you remember if the situation was the water better for you? Were people getting sick, or was it rough seas?
No, it was. I didn't have any problem that I remember in that. We landed at Utah Beach before we disembarked.
And then what was the situation like when you arrived at Utah Beach?
The main fighting was over. The beach was in... Allied hands.
Was this a point where a lot of supplies were coming in? Were a lot of people getting in there? Was it a crowded beach where they were trying to organize things together?
I can't remember that. I don't remember that. Okay. As I remember, I don't think there was much activity there. That was more over towards the Omaha Beach, which is where the brunt of the fleet. That's where the U.S. troops took the biggest hit. I think that's where they did most of the unloading, but I don't remember. I don't know. I don't remember that.
And then Did they have a few days where you waited to get organized and then you were sent out?
I'd say that we went up and bivouacked for like, I'm thinking probably 10 days, maybe.
And this is the point where you're assigned to General Patton at this point?
August 1st.
And did you have any reaction? Do you remember if there was any reaction amongst the people when you found out who you were being assigned to? Was Patton's reputation already established to a certain point, or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're proud to be under. Yeah.
I know when I was reading the information that you sent, you talked a lot about some of the leadership that you had during your service, some of the leaders of the General Patton, and then some of the leaders in the division. Going in, when you arrived there, was there a sense that you had strong leadership?
We thought we were some of the best once we, that's what I, as I remember. We can talk about it though, our crew, we can talk about that stuff.
What type of stuff would you have been discussing, or what type of things were you
going? Oh, mademoiselles, or or where are we going to get the next wine, or who's going to shoot at us next, things like that. Yeah. Or back home stuff once in a while, not too much.
Was that ever an issue with being around a bunch of people from St. Louis? Were there any conflicts between...
No.
Cleveland's fan and a...
No, don't always think it maybe get ribbed or that, but no, they were great guys. We got on just fine with them. Besides, you know, you may not be there the next day.
And then what happened when you finally started to move? You were part of the breakout, correct? Is that...
St. Louis. Okay. Like I said, Patton's Third Army became operational August the 1st. Our breakout was at St. Louis. Our objective was Brittany Peninsula, Brest, city at the bottom of the peninsula. So, we were supposed to take it, but we never could because our G2 intelligence didn't have the right information. They underestimated the amount of troops in Brest. They figured there was 10,000 there or something like 40,000. They had some of our outfits try to take it, but they couldn't.
Did you have any initial experiences with French people when you arrived? How soon before you started seeing French people? And do you remember what kind of response they gave? Was there a celebration that they?
Oh yeah, they were glad to see us. Every time we got through, boy, they'd be out waving flags. And I remember one town down in the Brittany Peninsula. They, one of them, I don't know, was a guy or lady, whatever, they had a sign out that said, "Thanks for coming." I wish that I had a camera, but I didn't. Yeah, oh, they came out and they gave us wine and all that stuff.
I knew you were commenting about how you found out soon after that the American equipment wasn't as good as you were told it was. Do you remember around when that happened? Was that very early on you realized?
Oh, yeah. See, we got in combat. Oh, they had a lot better. They had the best machine guns, best tanks. But we had our 50 caliber machine. That gun was a good one. But they had a 20 millimeter, just as good, but... Our M1, they used the old bolt action Mausers, you know. M1 is a good weapon. Dependable, very dependable. But they had their machine guns, ours were Stone Age compared to theirs. If we had to change a barrel, you had like a 30 caliber Browning. You had to screw it in, and then you had to get the proper headspace by backing it off so many notches and stuff. They could change the barrel and errors in 5 seconds. They just had a lever, they zipped it out, they have gloves because it'd be hot. But they just slap another end, bang like that, and slap it closed. There's no adjustment, they're smart. good equipment. Their machine guns, an MG-42 for the Schmeitzer machine pistol, like 20 rounds a second. Ours were 13 rounds a second. But the disadvantage of that was they, for a machine gunner and crew, they had to carry an extra ammo man because they went through so much ammunition because of the rate of fire. Mm-hmm. So they had to have a three-man machine gun crew instead of two. That was a disadvantage for them. But they had good airplanes too, although we had good airplanes too.
During the Brittany part, was this still, you would see German airplanes fairly frequently?
Oh yeah. Yeah, they strafed us and everything.
What would a typical day be like early on for you when you first started leaving out towards Brittany? Were you moving constantly every day or?
Always. Patton says, what was the word? The French, I don't know the correct pronunciation, but what he meant was audacity. Patton, you don't back up. Factors, this is a true story. I think the 15th Tank Battalion, there's one guy there, Patton was, he was up front a lot, by the way. He wasn't any rear, you can't command from the back. But anyway, this driver got back of a telephone pole or something, and Patton jumped up on his tank and said, "What the hell's the matter with you?" or whatever. And the guy said, "That pole's me." He said, "Well," Patton says, "Well," the guy said, "The pole's in my way. I have to back up." He said, Patton said, "Back up, hell," he says, "Put it in gear and run it over, lock it down." That's a true story. He didn't back up with Patton.
So what were you moving constantly all the time, or would it be, did you camp for the night, or how would you?
Oh, we'd stop for it at night, yeah.
And would they?
Unless there was a night attack on our part, or a counterattack.
Would they set up a perimeter, or how would?
Oh, yeah.
Were you, and how far would you have been from, you were held a little further back because you're providing support.
That's right. We weren't, when I was with the FO section, we were right with the infantry, the lieutenant and I. But I carried the radio and stuff. He's the one that did the charting and so forth. But when I was with the tank crew, yeah, we'd be, but you never know. Sometimes we'd be 5 miles behind the front. We may be a mile behind the front. You never know.
And at this
no,
point,
not usually 7 miles.
And at this point, you're mentioning that the front really could have been any. The only thing that was American held territory that I was reading that you were saying was the road.
Exactly right.
So you're surrounded by what's considered.
We didn't have a front, man. We were in a tank. We weren't supposed to be stationary. We kept moving forward all the time.
And then you eventually reached your objective. You couldn't take the place, you couldn't, that was, did you just leave it or did someone else take it or?
No, they pulled us out of there and I can't tell you who it was, but some infantry divisions came in.
But they were cut off by then. Anyway,
yeah, they just bottled them up. I think they finally did take it. Somebody took it though. Some infantry, it wasn't the 6th Armored though. They moved us up to Lorient, which is up from Brest on the same side of the coast. Okay. I don't know how far away it is, maybe 150 miles, I don't know. And basically there, we didn't try to take Lorient. They had a lot of, that's where they had all the submarine pens and so forth. But it was mostly a holding situation for us.
And again, even at this point, you're just being told what to do every day. There's not a real, you don't really know what's going on in the grand scheme of things. You're just a smaller part of the big picture.
Exactly. Like I told you, we never knew where we were going. I know that. But Lorient, I remember we were probably about 3 miles out of Lorient. We get shelled every once in a while. We build a dugout thing with a roof over, dirt and stuff. And we get, and finally we saw these civilians, I'm assuming they were French civilians, they walk up, we finally figured out they were telling the Germans where we were. So that crap stopped. We didn't let them walk up and down that road anymore because they'd walk down and walk until the Germans where our position was, you know. And we wonder why Germans could hit us almost dead on. They knew where we were. We stopped that.
And around, do you remember how long you were at Lorien? Or?
Yeah. I don't remember exactly. I'd say maybe a week, maybe possibly 2 weeks. I don't know.
Do you have any sense of what was the early experience like for people? Was the morale pretty high initially, or what was it like to be involved with this initial
people,
stage?
People, you talking about the French civilians?
I'm talking about the men that you served with. What would it have been like after you had gone through and campaigned in Brittany? Do you have any sense what the mood would have been like?
Yeah, we were scared. Yeah. Hey, get through today, but how about tomorrow?
Yeah.
We lost guys. I had a guy get hit 3 feet from me, but I didn't get it. It happened more than once. But who knows why? Yeah. Survival.
Did you already start having replacements, or what time did replacements come in? Was that almost immediately, or was that further?
I'd say at Brest, we lost a couple of guys. Yeah. Which wouldn't have been immediately, but it was probably within 10 days of when we went to combat. Yeah. Yeah.
And then after Lorien is when you start making, there's a push made across France. Is that correct?
That's right.
And did the attitude ever change? Because I know, looking at where your unit went, you were covering a fair amount of ground pretty consistently.
That's right.
It seemed like you were always moving. And
we're always on the move.
Did that help morale at all, knowing that you were advancing, or was it the similar just...
I wouldn't say it helped morale. It just... No.
You were still in a dangerous situation, and you knew that.
Oh, yeah. In combat, you think it's never going to end. I got through today, okay? Am I going to make it tomorrow? I don't know. No.
And was this advance across France, was this... what was the experience like with regards to resistance? Were you facing more...
Not too much, because we were going so fast, we hit them, got them off guard and stuff, that no, we want to cross there pretty fast, really. Didn't go through Paris, though. I mean, we bypassed Paris. About 20 mile. I never got to Paris. Good thing, I guess. But when we went to cross France, we were heading for Nancy. We bypassed Paris, I think, on the left side, and went through around Metz and what's that? World War I, Chateau Thierry and all that stuff. But I'm coming back, we went 20 mile on the other side, so I never did go to Paris. And I can't tell you how long it took us to go across there. I just don't remember that.
And do you remember?
Pretty fast,
do you remember, just from your personal standpoint, one of the things I'm curious about is communication. Was there a period you could receive letters, or as long as you're moving, was it fairly difficult for the army to get communication to correspondence to you, or?
They're very good about that. And we did get letters with regularity. That's one thing. Even if we were in position, I mean, the company clerk would come around and hand out letters, you know.
So at least you had that communication was always established.
That part was good.
And as you're sort of getting to the edge of France and closer to the German border, that's where the decision's made for you to stop. Is that correct?
At Nancy. Well, we had to, because we actually outran our supply line. And our equipment needed maintenance. We had to change tracks in Nancy, because when we started out, we had metal cleats on the track. The whole track was metal. We're tearing up the towns we were going through, because we go around a corner and tank it slide, and they're plowing up all the curbs and stuff. This through.
What type of repairs would a tank like yours have? Would it just be that the tracks have problems? Were there any mechanical difficulties? What kinds of things might go wrong with?
Well, like I said, we changed the tracks, and the new tracks we put on were rubber cleats. had rubber on them. And we also changed engine, because when we started out, we had a 9-cylinder airplane engine with radio. What were they? Continental. Whatever. We changed it and put a Ford, if I remember, Ford gasoline V8 engine in it. Because that Continental airplane engine had a lot of problems fouling plugs, because those engines were made to run full RPM all the time. And we had a lot of idles on. And those engines don't like to be idle. So that's why, I imagine that's why they changed it, but I don't know.
I think it was reading in your accounts that the vehicle you were in was also not very fuel efficient. It didn't get much
gallons in a mile.
So you would need resupplied fairly consistently.
That was a lot of times that was done right on the road where we're moving, believe it or not. The truck would pull up beside us and they had 5-gallon jerry cans. They just hand them over while we're going down the road.
Do you know how much gas could fit in a tank, or?
I don't remember anymore. If I'm gonna guess, I don't know. I should know that, but I don't. It was a lot though. 100 gallon, I don't know.
And then once you sort of went out of the supply lines, or once you were told that you had to stop, what was the situation like then? Did you form a defensive line, or what was the situation that happened then?
And that we just stayed in that for a couple of weeks like that, because we had to do, like I said, vehicle maintenance, and our supply lines had to catch up to us, because we just outran them. We had to stop.
But
could have kept on going though, if we could have, because we just, that's why Patton believed, you know, when you're on the attack, you got them on a run, keep them on the run. You stop, that's when they can set up their defenses, and then it makes it a lot tougher when you start again. But we had to stop there for that reason.
And for the most part, during this whole trek across France, you were well supplied with, food, supplies, anything you needed during this?
Yep, we were. That's one thing, we of course, most of our, we a lot of times we didn't have a kitchen with some of the, like, your rear echelon, that would be the ideal situation, but we weren't, we were right in the front all the time. But a lot of times we lived on K rations or C rations.
You didn't, since you were moving, you didn't have an opportunity to look for anything except what the Army's giving you.
Nope. That's right. Oh, no. No, we never lived off the land or that, as far as that part. We were always supplied by what the Army. So I said K rations or C rations. They weren't too bad, but you don't want a D ration.
What was the difference between rations?
C rations were pretty good. They'd have like hash and cans and stuff like that. K rations were like a Cracker Jack box. They weren't too bad. I don't remember all of it anymore. It's been a long time, but some would have cheese in them and little packages and stuff. D-ration, you don't want that, though. The square chocolate bar, about that big, and it was the bitterest stuff you ever tasted. Solid. You can already bite it off like biting a piece of cement. That's a D-ration. But we got them once in a while, and that's it.
And when you stop,
occasionally, once we were stopped for any period of time, then the kitchen would come up. They had a truck, you know, on their 6x, and they could cook us. It was a rare occasion, but treasured to get a good meal.
When you eventually stopped towards the border, were you better supplied with food? Did the supplies get better when you started?
Well, we got what they called A rations, or was that the one of the field truck? Yeah, mm-hmm. That's good. But usually in combat, we didn't get that. We had to live out of the box. And coffee, boy, we drank coffee. We took a shell casing and we cut it down. We'd go to the kitchen and they had a lot of big. I don't know how they carry their coffee, but we'd get a load of it and put it in that thing. And we'd make coffee we had a system. We used a gallon Kiro can, and we'd build a fire out of the shell casing because they burn real fast and easy. And, get that water boiling. And we had a system. We had so much coffee we measured in it, and then we dumped cold water in it, and that would settle the grounds, and that was it. You probably aren't interested in this, but I'll tell you anyway.
Well, I'm interested in what life was like for you, so that's definitely something
I want to... Well, that'll fit.
And this was... I think I read that you would make coffee like 3 times a day. Is that...
Yeah.
Would this be... You would have to be stopped, or could you make
coffee? No. We had to be stopped. You couldn't make it going down. Because we built a fire, you know. We used our shell casings. They were like... Our rounds came... For our main gun came in a case about that high. And they were like... they had a lid to fit on them. The stuff was about, the casing was about that thick. It was like real heavy tar paper, only it wasn't tar paper, it was waterproof stuff. Couldn't get it, you know. And we used those to make the fire, to make our coffee. So we didn't have to look for firewood or that when we made it. Well, we had that down to a system. One thing we did enjoy, our coffee.
And you were stopped near the border. What happened next, or what was next for you? How you were there? You were getting better supplies, or you were eating better meals there.
The next for me was that's when I got signed to the FO section. And I was with them for a couple of months, the lieutenant, handsman, and me. And that's when we hit the Maginot line. I mean the Siegfried line. Well, the Maginot was there also, but that was...
Was there a specific reason why you were assigned to be as an FO?
They just needed an assistant for Lieutenant Hansman.
Did you volunteer, or were you told?
No, I was told.
And what was the difference? Did they train you, or how was training to be in?
No, Lieutenant Hansman told me what to do. I carried the radio mainly and stuff. Got shot at a lot more up there.
What was the relationship like when you got... You were near infantrymen. You probably
all the time.
Were you around them as much earlier, or was this your first real experience?
No. When you're with the artillery thing, you aren't with the infantry.
What was their feelings towards you as an FO? How did they treat you?
They were happy to see us there. But if you're in a tank... Don't go around the infantry. Don't tell them to get the hell out of there. Tanks draw fire. No, in a tank you don't want to be. They'll tell you to get out. But if they need you, of course, then they're happy to see you.
But if you're a forward observer, that's a different relationship you're bringing the artillery support.
We're the ones that help them out, boy.
Were you assigned to a specific company, or how is a forward observer assigned?
I can't tell you that. We were assigned to somebody, but I don't know who.
Were you with the same group for an extended period of time, or did you? So you moved around.
We moved around.
Where they thought
they needed the support, the artillery support. That's where we hit all the. I wrote in my thing here. We hit the pillboxes on the secret line. Those pillboxes were like 8 feet thick. They're just like a big room, big house. They had a lot of rooms in them. They're pretty nice inside. I went in a few of them. They had kitchens in there and everything.
Did you have any experience up to that point with... I know you had commented about in your writing about seeing a dead German soldier, but had you seen German prisoners of war at any point, or had you any experience seeing... living German soldiers at that time? Or?
Oh, yeah. Well, right after we got into combat, we started seeing them. Dead ones. And some were soldiers dead also. But yeah.
Did you notice at any point, or notice at specific points, that the soldiers that they had were either younger or older than you anticipated? Did you notice that in Brittany, or maybe did you notice that in the Siegfried line?
No. No, they were... Just soldiers, I mean, they weren't old. And course, a lot of the German soldiers, when they were conscripted, you know, some of them weren't necessarily German. They'd get some from Norway or Poland or whatever. They needed cannon fodder, you know. Germans did.
Was there a sense amongst your unit that the Germans were starting to break?
No, I didn't notice that. No. Not yet. Later on, yes, but not when we hit the secret line. No, they were gung-ho. The ones you really didn't want to fight against were the SS and the young kids, Hitler Jugend. They're brainwashed. Damn good fighters, really. The SS, they were. We didn't like them. There were a lot of them taken prisoner and they didn't make it back. The SS, you know what they were. Hitler's bodyguard. Mm-hmm. Schutzstaffel, I think the German name for it, which is beside the point. But, they were gung-ho.
Of course, you'd remark that there was a certain amount of understanding and respect for their abilities in terms of their equipment, and then in terms of their, I know you've said in your writings about their skill as in artillery specifically. I remember you writing about how they were very talented.
They were good. Yeah, they used tree burst a lot. We used air burst a lot. We fought a lot of, they call it time fire. We fired a lot of that.
What types of changes had happened in the first few months with regards to what you had been trained to do and maybe what you were doing in combat because it made more sense? Was this something where the airburst became a more effective weapon for you, or had there been any changes where things worked?
In artillery, that you use it, it's the same method. If you have anti-personnel, you use HE or time. We could set those time fires so they fire like when they're coming down, when the infantry was attacking or whatever. We could set those things so they'd fire like 20, 25 feet over their heads and go off. You don't want to be around when one of those happen, let me tell you. That stuff's flying everywhere. We could set the time fuse to do that through the forward observer. Because he's the one that say, hey, you know, the thing, you just drop it down a second or whatever, pick it up, move it up a second, bursting too early or too late. HE is very effective too against anti-personnel. Then we use smoke for camping. If you want to cover a withdrawal or whatever, you don't say retreat, withdrawal. That's the proper word. But smoke, they couldn't see then, you know.
And as the year's sort of winding down and it's getting colder, is the military supplying you with the proper gear at that point? Are you getting the heavier clothes?
We got good. We were better equipped than the infantry. I don't know why. When it got cold, we got around Bastogne. They provided us with, we wore the wool OD, dark wool OD uniform, shirt and pants. But when it started getting cold, they provided us with goulashes, which helped a hell of a lot, because just shoes and that, your feet, we had a lot of problems with frozen feet, by the way, toes. I didn't, but a lot of the guys did. And they provided us with it was like, you call it twill on the outside, I don't know, the tan type thing. But the inside is lined with wool, again, all wool line. They're like cover all the like suspenders on them and the zipper on the front. and then a jacket over that yet. And that was all wool lined, like a blanket lined inside with a twill on the outside. They had two sets of gloves. One was a mitten made out of, I'm thinking wool. And then over that was a big heavy canvas thing you could pull up here and had a strap on, you could tighten it up. Had a trigger finger in each hand. Yeah, the knit hats you could pull down on your head like that.
And when you were moving, or when you spent the night, did you set up tents, or how would you?
We did have a tent in our, but most of the guys, but not, we couldn't use it all the time. But when we, if we could, we set it up, yeah. And we even had a stove that you could set up inside the thing, which we did use, but you couldn't do that all the time. It only depended on the situation. Sometimes you just couldn't.
And if you couldn't, would you stay in the tank, or would you stay near the tank? How would you?
Lay out in the ground or in a hole.
What was the situation like? Could everyone sit comfortably inside the tank, or how was that arranged?
We could all fit in okay. Because we'd have a commander, he'd sit, we didn't have any seats in there, we had a stand, but the driver had a seat, and then number one man, he's the guy that worked the elevation on the gun, he had a seat. That was right by the priest, the pulpit thing on that side. He had a little seat he could sit on. That was the only two, but then the rest of it, we just stood up, you know. So, and ducked down a lot of times, but.
Was that, if you were moving, is that what you would do? You'd be inside, standing up?
That's right. And I'm not usually standing up, because too good of a target. You keep low. Because like I said, I mean, all we control was the road we were on. I mean, who knows what's there or there or up there.
So at this point in late 1944, that's when the Germans make their attack, correct?
The Ardennes.
Yes, and that you're called to reinforce them?
We were down in Sar Valley at that time, down around Lorraine. And Patton said they needed help up here where they had the breakthrough was. Patton told Eisenhower, I can do it. I'll move my whole army up there. They said, you can't do it. So he told me, I don't know, these are just what I've read. And I wasn't there, you know, in a conversation or anything. And he said he could do it, and he did. He pulled us out of there, and we traveled night and day for about a day and a half to get up there.
Do you remember what the mood was like with your men when that was happening? Did you know that this was going to be bad combat, or?
Oh yeah, we know it's bad because there's a big breakthrough up there. We didn't know how far they were gonna go. And we were sent up there to stop them, so you know. As far as my feelings and all these, I don't remember all that. All I know is I was getting shot at a hell of a lot, and I was scared. Mm-hmm. I know that. But I can't tell you just what my feelings were.
You arrived in Bastogne eventually, within a day and a half, is that?
That's right, yep.
And did that sort of, what happened next for you? Was the?
Well, they just pulled us into position, we started a fire. But the 4th and 6th Armored were Patton's two divisions, armored divisions. He had other ones with him after that, but we were his main two. We started out with him, we were with him, not all the way through, because we got transferred to, all depending what area you were in, you were in that army, okay? And one time we got down to 7th Army area, so we were transferred for like a week to the 7th Army. But basically we were 3rd Army all the time, which was Patton.
And I think you said that this was the first time that you had seen General Patton was...
I saw him twice.
And the first time was near Bastogne, correct? Or was in a jeep?
The first time was... That's right. We were in a field, but I didn't know it. Going down the road, there's two peeps. We call them peeps in the armored. Everybody else calls them jeeps. Those for armored force, those are peeps. The jeeps are the bigger command cars, like they're a little bigger. I learned that right after I got in the armored force. So it's a peep as far as, anyway, there's two of them. And one of the guys said, "Hey, oh, there goes," it was snowing, I remember that. He said, "Hey, there goes Patton." And it was probably, he's probably, I'm gonna guess, 7,500 yards from us. It wasn't real close, because we were off in a field in firing position. He's going down, and we were getting shell occasionally then too, but he drove right down the road like he owned it, and went right on into Bastion. We were about a mile out of Bastion, firing in and over, around. But I saw him there, and I saw him in the Rhine River, when we crossed the Rhine River. He's on the left bank, and I saw his, somebody said his pearl handle revolver, and you don't want to tell him that, because they weren't pearl handle. They were ivory handle. He said, "Pearl handle revolvers are for pimps that run whorehouses in New Orleans. They're ivory handle." I saw it, but he and our General Groh, our division, they were standing right together there as we crossed the Rhine on the, you've seen the Rhine River?
Mm-hmm.
Wide, isn't it?
Yes.
We crossed that on a pontoon bridge.
Was that near Cologne or?
Oppenheim. Oppenheim, where we crossed. Yeah. And he kind of, Patton went across on his own. They told him, "No, don't cross, da da da." But he saw an opening there and or the chance to cross, and he did. Yeah, I remember that like yesterday, crossing there.
So this was a few months later. What was that like? If you could just describe what it was like crossing the Rhine.
Well, like I told you, I know it was a wide. I was surprised how wide it was. That the river's wide, and I don't know. I just once we, I do remember. I said, "What the hell are we gonna get into here now?" Once we got on the other side, you know.
So crossing the river didn't mean
it didn't mean that much.
Yeah, it didn't mean that the war was getting closer.
It did the Patton, though, and our general did the same thing, because. And I didn't see it, but I know it happened. They both went out in the middle of that bridge and pissed right in the middle of the Rhine River. He said one of his goals in life was to do that. And they did, but I didn't see it. But I, like I told you in my writings, when you're in basic training or that, a lot of times the rumors are rumors. But in combat, if you hear a rumor, it's usually true. And some of the stuff that I wrote about, I couldn't prove, but I know it happened. I know it. I know. Talked to people that saw it.
Now that you've entered Germany, the people that you're meeting have a lot different attitude towards Americans than what you'd seen in France.
Oh, yeah. France, man, we were welcome. Christ.
And then probably
the mademoiselles would jump up on a tank and everything, but not in Germany. Uh-uh. There wasn't anybody throwing any flowers in front of us. No, when we go through towns, there'd be white sheets hanging out of the window.
Just meaning that they had surrendered, or?
That's right. Oh, they didn't want to get shot at. No, we didn't get any welcoming committee in Germany. Nowhere.
Did you have much experience seeing German civilians, or were they sort of hidden?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we were in their country all the time. We weren't supposed to fraternize with them or nothing like that, you know. But we did. And a lot of Germans could talk English. They taught it over there. You know, a lot of them learned it. Surprising. French, not so much in France. Germans were much cleaner, though.
I remember that you remarked in your writing that there were, I think, chickens in the kitchens in France, or
that's
something you had noticed. And
You read my stuff well. Yeah. And farmers, you go, I saw them running through the kitchens in France, not in Germany. And they wore a lot of wooden shoes in France. Well, the farmers, particularly the farmers and so forth.
was there any difference in, for instance, maybe requisitioning buildings or using a building to stay in? Would you have been more likely to do that in Germany because they were an enemy than France? Or was it just being next to something that you needed?
We needed it. We didn't mess around.
You didn't care who owned it.
No, it didn't matter where it was. However, we didn't have access to buildings very often because we were, like I told you, we were on a charge all the time.
And I can imagine it's harder for a tank to park in the middle of a town than it is to park outside of a town. That would seem like where you're going to stop is not going to be in the center of a town as much.
Yeah, we didn't worry about that, though. We stopped where we wanted. Who was going to stop us? We were going through, when we were going into Belgium, though, the Bastogne, we stopped. And I can tell you, if I looked it up, the name of the village in the middle of Ardennes there, beautiful country, by the way. You've probably been there, I don't know.
I haven't been there, no.
Beautiful. I wouldn't say it's mountainous, but it's really hilly, and snow everywhere, and I remember we were going, it was dark, and we had to stop for the night, or did stop for the night. And I don't know who made the arrangements, but we pulled right up our tank right in front of this house, parked like you park your car out there in the driveway, and we stayed in that house that night. The civilians, though, they're in another part, they stayed in another part of the house, like in the kitchen or whatever. We were in the living room. That's where we stayed that night. You talk about parking the tank, that's what we did. We just pull up in front of the house. And I don't know how, each tank took another house, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess most of them were friendly with us, but I don't remember. I don't think we had much of a conversation with the family that I know. But boy, it's cold in Bastogne. Got to 13 below sometime.
Wow.
Try sleeping in a hole.
Is there anything where you will, how could you provide warmth? Could you set up tents at that point, or were you not supposed to?
We did occasionally. All depends. Yeah, if we were going to be there for a day or two or a couple of days, we could set up our thing and we'd go out and get whatever wood, wherever necessary. We'd have to chop some days, shed down, it didn't matter. Then sometimes you couldn't, and we'd have fire missions at night too. All depends, because the Germans, they counterattacked it in the dark too, you know, just like we did.
And you were no longer a forward observer at Bastogne, or were you still forward?
No, I was back with the crew then, around the Siegfried Line. That's when I was with the UFO section.
And when you arrived in Germany and you crossed the Rhine River, the same tank crew, the same group you had been with from the beginning?
Well, we had a couple of replacements because we had a couple of guys wounded and stuff.
But it was the same tank?
And fortunately, we never got our tank shot out from under us, but we did. You know, the left side had a lot of paint taken off it, but we were just lucky. Some of them weren't so lucky, but once we got into Germany, it was a different situation. The Germans weren't friendly, but they didn't know what we were going to do either. You know, we may decide to shoot them, you know, I don't even know, because they were our enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw any mistreatment like that. I know the Russians did, but I didn't see it myself. But they were submissive at that point. Besides, they knew they were going to lose the war at that point.
Did you have any desire once you crossed the Rhine? Was there any thought amongst the people in your unit that you wanted to get to Berlin, or was that something you just wanted the war to end? What was
there was. I don't remember ever discussing that. Yeah, we all wanted the war to end. That was the main thing. But like I told you, it just seemed endless. It was going to go on and on, you know.
And this was, you had still been on, you had had, did you have any time where you were taken off the line, or what was your How often were you allowed to leave the line or given any time off or any period of relaxation?
The only time we were taking off, not only me, but our whole crew, was around NC. That's when I went, got that, they gave us passes because we knew they were going to have downtime there for a couple of weeks, and we had to do tank maintenance. And,
so this would have just been a few weeks period where they allowed people to have time off.
They would take, I think, I don't remember, we draw straws or whatever to go. We got, it was, I got a pass to go to NC. I don't remember, you know, how long, probably 2 days, I don't know. Maybe it's a weekend. That's where I ran into my friend that I brought in there, but I grew up with from the 35th Infantry Division. We call him, his name was Delmer Cole, we call him Rome, Romeo. He looked bad.
Did you notice that when you went to see, was he typical of the infantrymen that you would work with as a forward observer? Was there that sense that they had seen a lot? I know in your writing, you wrote a lot about the suffering of the infantry, how it was different from the armor. And
they had a lot worse than we did. Yeah. Like I told you, even in the winter, we had the best clothing. Why did they give it to the infantry? I don't know. They didn't have the stuff we had. They're the ones that should have had it. They deserve everything infantry, I'll tell you that. I'm glad I wasn't one. I mean, that, like I told you, I saw those guys, we call them the Million Mile Steer Boy. They get so much calm. That's what Rome had when I saw him, that my friend. Isn't that something? 3,000 miles away, I ran to the guy I grew up with.
Did you meet a whole lot of people from your area, or was that typical? Would you?
No, he's the only one.
When you ran into, if you met an infantry unit or if you met another group, would there be that kind of chatter back and forth just where people are from, or
no.
Was it do your business and keep going?
There was no chatter, period. The only time, once in a while, we ran into the 4th Armored, we always thought we were better than they were, and they thought that they were better than us. We'd say, well, where have you been? It's all over now, you know. That type of thing. But other than that, no, it wasn't any of this camaraderie, but nah.
And once you cross the Rhine River, this is probably February of 45 or something around then, is that correct?
That's right.
So the war would have lasted just a few more months.
It could have been maybe another month later than that, even.
Okay. So this would be the last...
The war was over in, what, May the 1st, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We knew that they were going to lose, and they knew they were going to lose, but they still would fight. But not as hard, except for, like I told you, the SS and the Hitler Youth. They were diehard, brainwashed. You know, that auto gas there, we ran into those anti-aircraft guns that they lowered. Well, that's where I rode in there, where they got the whole column. That column was about a mile long, and I'd say that hill was a slight, maybe grade, I don't know, 15 degrees or whatever, I don't know. And they started at the top, they lowered those ACAC guns, and they worked right down. Got them, I don't know if they got all of them, but they set a lot of them on fire. We were at the bottom. These guns were all over in here. Got them all. That's where they pulled us off the road and we got into a shooting match with them.
Then as the war's ending, you were saying that you had written about how you were in, I believe, Leipzig. Is that correct? Or where were you?
Leipzig.
When is that where you were when the war ended? Or do you remember where you heard
we,
about
no,
the story?
No, we went further than that. Leipzig is where the auto gas is where these anti-aircraft guns were. Then after we got out of that mess,
you went to Weimar at some point.
That's right. But we went to what were all the towns there? Zeiss was near there. Uh, just can't remember all the time. They're all like that the Thuringer, I think that's Thuringen. Thuringer. That area in Germany. Mm-hmm. Thuringer, whatever. They're all right in that area. That was our path. Castle. And after we left Leipzig, we continued on east and that's when we went through Weimar. And I wasn't in on the liberation of that camp, but I was there right after that because the infantry, Lieutenant Kiefer and the 9th Armored Infantry were the ones, first ones in there. What happened was that some of the inmates, they knew that we were coming or near. So they had an uprising like in the concentration camp, and they killed some of the guards. By the way, all the concentration camps were run by the SS. And they killed some of the guards, and then they got out and they wandered away from the camp a couple of miles, and that's when the 6th Armored ran into some of the inmates, and they told them about how bad it was back there, and they should check it out, da da da. That's when Captain Kiefer, that's when his patrol went into Buchenwald. But he had the orders not to stay there. He said, just go in, check it out, get on. I don't remember what the objective was, but get on to something else. But as I wrote in the thing, he had a hard time getting out of there because the inmates didn't want to let him go.
Did you have any sense that that was happening at any point before that, or was this a surprise to you too?
Oh, yeah. And some of the civilians out of Weimar, General Patton and our General Groh, made those civilians in Weimar all go through that concentration camp to show them that, yes, this is true. I guess I read that some people still don't believe that today, but ask me, I'll tell you. It's true. What's that?
Was there a situation where people were trying to provide them military food? I know I've read in other instances where there's a problem with trying to feed someone who's...
Oh, yeah, you can't.
Was there a situation where you warned not to do that at any point?
No. We knew we weren't supposed to. Because they die. I mean, there's nothing, skin and bones. Yeah. It's on my memory. I'm vague on a lot of that now.
Okay.
Yeah, 64 years ago or whatever. And that's where I told you I saw those lampshades made out of human dried tattooed skin. That's why you never see me with a tattoo. So, more than one. There's one, we were lucky, and I wrote my thing. An inmate gave us, about three or four of us, I don't remember who it was or the situation, but we got a guided tour through the camp. But they couldn't take us through the whole camp, because that concentration camp was big. Mm-hmm. But we got to see the important things, like the crematorium and that type of thing, where he dropped this Zyklon gas down through the hole, B. I saw all that. And there's one place we went there, and this inmate showed us, I can remember it yet, but the beam up there with the hooks on it, like a meat hook. That's where he said these British airmen, they strung him up there by the thumbs and tortured him. And he said, look at this, about that high off the floor, there's black marks on a wall. That's where they kicked the wall with their heels.
So that probably would have been an extreme, an emotional time first. But it also, did that, Did that change your attitude towards what the war was about at all, or?
No, I never remember thinking about what all the war was about and all that gung-ho, thing like that. We're just there to do a job, want to get it done with as quick as possible and get the hell out of there, you know? That's my attitude on the whole thing.
It seems like that's...
I didn't think about, oh, this is a great thing to do like all these politicians have. No, I didn't think about that.
You just wanted to get the job done and head home.
And get back. That's why when we got back home, we never talked about it.
Yep. And
we figured they're all like pretty much my thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We came home, we tried to forget that stuff. That one, I read an article in a paper, this lady, what the heck's her name? She's a journalist. I like to read her as a rule too, because but I didn't like what she wrote. Anyway, she wrote that once the World War II vets were a bunch of crybabies. That pissed me off. And I wished I could told her. We weren't. We were anything but. We didn't cry. We came home. We came home and tried to forget it.
Yeah.
But no, we didn't. I don't remember feeling gung-ho, you know, about that stuff. You shouldn't feel proud about what you had to go there and do.
Yeah.
That's my feeling.
When you found out that Germany had surrendered, I know that you wrote about how there was still the consideration, they were doing a point system and sending some people home, but for an individual like yourself, there was still the possibility of being sent to the Pacific.
That's right. 85 points you got sent back home. Like, I was in the 6th Armored, and the 6th Armored was scheduled to be sent back to the United States deactivated.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the third, I got sent to the 3rd Armored. You needed 85 points. If I had 85 points, I'd have stayed in the 6th and come home. I'd been home a couple months earlier than I was. But I had 83 points. I was 2 points shy.
Do you have any idea what they gave points for or why you were 2 points shy?
Yeah. For longevity of service.
Which you would have had.
Not really. Some of those guys were in 5, 6 years. Okay. I was only in 3.
Oh, since they were in the National Guard unit, they had been in.
I imagine their time counted there, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And wounds that gave you so many points. Decorations, points, overseas time. I had almost 2 years overseas. They gave you extra points for that. I was too shy anyway. 2 more, I'd have been home earlier. So I got sent from the 6th Armored to the 3rd Armored in Frankfurt, Germany.
And it wasn't your crew. You were sent assigned to
Oh, exactly. No, just myself. That was it. Because some of the guys in my crew, especially the old-timers, the National Guard guys, they had enough points to go home. And the 3rd Armored was scheduled to go to the Pacific. And like I told and wrote my thing, I just knew I'd never come back from there. Or it wouldn't be in one piece. You know, you missed so many times, you know, let's face it. So I just had that feeling.
This was through May, May, June, July. It's sort of just a waiting period where you don't know what's going to happen. You're thinking that you can be sent over.
Except when the bomb went off, then we knew the Pacific War was over. And then it was just a matter of getting home, because they were going to discharge everybody, you know.
Once, during that waiting period, did anything change with regards to the restrictions they placed on you? Were you, I know you said that you got to go to the opera in one place in Germany.
Oh, yeah. That was in Weimar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what a deal. I had a guard duty there. Unbelievable. In fact, after the war was over, I couldn't believe what a great detail I had and stuff. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah, we stood. I don't know what the hell the guard duty is about, but there was about three of us. It was the, I remember the opera was Carmen. Mm-hmm. It was in Weimar, the National Theater there, which is a big theater. So we had, and all the pretty girls would go by us every afternoon. We're in the show, you know. That was a great duty.
Did you go exploring around the area too, or what? How would your day have changed with regards to free time? Were you allowed to do a lot more? Were you given a lot more passes?
Yeah, except I didn't go that much, really. And we're right in Weimar there. We're staying in a SS barracks. It was a previous SS barracks. We had a good place to stay there.
Is this where they had a swimming pool and everything? Or?
Oh, no, that was after I went to the Third Armor. Mm-hmm. That's where we had the swimming pool. I was unbelievable, like a ultra super club. You know what I mean? A beautiful staircase and inside. It was just like you'd see in a movie. Mm-hmm. In this Olympic-sized swimming pool. They allowed the girls to, one day to swim, and we weren't allowed to swim with them, the German mm-hmm. civilian girls. And this one guy said, "Hey, there's a shed next to him." He said, "There's two or he told a couple." He says, "Come on in here." He said, "You can peek through the hole here and see the girls undressing." So we did. I shouldn't say this, but what the hell happened? And, there's this. Little crack in the slats or the shed next to where they changed, you know what I mean? So we.
And then this, after you went from Weimar to this location when you were with the Third Armor, do you remember around, were you there with the Third Armor a few months or?
The Third Armor was in Frankfurt.
Okay.
The Sixth Armor was in Weimar.
Okay.
And so I stayed with the Third Armor. That was. Actually, we didn't do a thing, but just pass the time there. We didn't practice.
No training, no nothing.
There's a great big.
Did you have to pull any guard duty of any opera houses in Frankfurt, or was it just
no? They didn't have no.
Stay out of trouble and.
Yeah, enjoy the swimming pool and the Fräuleins, and we weren't supposed to fraternize though, but we did. In fact, there was a. Patton City, they under the threat of being shot, but it didn't work. We did, but we had a real unbelievable setup. And after I went to the Third Armor, they had a big Olympic track there. I mean, whatever. I got into that. I was a pretty good athlete when I was young. And they had a thing in the division for the best, whoever got the best scores. Mm-hmm. We got like 20 cases of beer or something like that. We won. Like I said, I was pretty good.
And then it's,
I don't mean to be bragging, but I could run and stuff like that.
And then at some point, I know in your writing, it says that you had to return the tanks to a specific area. Was this when you
Stuttgart.
Were with,
we
when you were with the Third Armor? Is that when you did
no,
that?
No, that was the one. I was still with the Sixth
okay.
Armor.
So this is when you went through Heidelberg down to Stuttgart.
That's correct.
Okay.
Stuttgart. Yeah. Parked them all on a hill. I remember there was vehicles as far as you could see up there. Probably lowered them down. Whatever. I don't know what they did with them. Yeah, we parked them just like that. You know, just when I think the Bill Adamack are. Tank commander said, "Hey, I don't remember how it was, but he said, you want to take a trip?" Or he asked me anyway. I didn't, it wasn't a volunteer type thing. Mm-hmm. And the whole crew didn't go. He just asked me if I wanted to go along. So I'm glad I did. Yeah, that's where we parked it.
And I know in your writing, there wasn't, when you left the tank, it wasn't an extremely emotional experience for you. It was just sort of a tank's gone. Go back and then eventually
get sent. No, there wasn't anything emotional involved about it with me. No, I'm glad to be out of it.
And what time of year did you find out that you were heading back? This would have, after the bombs dropped, so would this have been as early as August, or was it into September? When did you head back to the United States?
I can't tell you that exactly, but after the bomb dropped, we knew it was over. And that was in, what, August? They dropped the bomb. Well, we knew that that would be just a matter of time going home. I just don't remember.
And then did you take a train out, or did you fly out to France and then take a boat there, or how did you?
Nobody flew then.
Okay.
Like, nobody. You take a train, or else be trucked in a 6x6 truck.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember. I think I was trucked, but I'm not sure. I don't remember that anymore.
Okay.
That's a detail I don't remember. But I went to Marseille, and that's where I left from Marseille.
So down on the...
To go home.
Okay. So a little bit longer voyage than some people had, I would imagine.
Yeah, because we had to go... I remember going through the Strait of Gibraltar, you know, with Spain on one side, mm-hmm. Morocco on the other, or whatever.
And do you remember where the boat landed? Was this New York, or did...
New York. Again. Yeah.
And did you...
I remember one thing, though. I always said, when they flush the toilet of the world, it's going to come out in Marseille, France, or New York City. Take your pick. Because I remember that harbor in Marseille, was just crap thrown up. I don't mean literally crap, but I mean garbage and junk floating around that harbor when we left. But I said he hadn't spent any time there. Well, excuse me, you were going to ask another question.
Well, I was just going to ask, when you arrived in New York, was there still celebrations going on? Was there any kind of people meeting you?
Yeah, I think a fire hose went off or something when we pulled into the dock. And I don't remember that. I can't answer that question. I don't remember. There could have been a Red Cross donut wagon there or something like that. But
Did you go immediately from New York to Youngstown, or did they give you...
No, you had to go and get separation center.
Okay.
Like, you name the name of the camp, I'd say it wasn't Camp Kilmer, no, I don't, whatever. Mm-hmm. It was a camp in Jersey, anyway. For the separation center, and they sent us there, and that's where you get discharged.
Okay.
And from there, they give you a train ticket to wherever your home is.
And so you went...
I went by train.
So you went by train to Youngstown?
Well, I went to Washington because my girlfriend at the time, my wife, was in Washington. She served in the Navy.
So it's to Washington State?
Washington, D.C.
Oh, Washington, D.C.
And so I went to see her first.
Were you married at that time, or were you still? Okay.
We didn't get married until I got home. I want to be sure I was in one piece yet.
What was the communication like? Did you get letters monthly, weekly? How often were you communicating during the war?
Often.
Okay.
She was very good at that. She wrote me, and my mother, same thing. Yeah. They're good about the mail. We used email. What they call that mail in?
The
you know what I'm talking about. Not email.
The telegram?
V-mail. Oh. It was a V-mail. Right? Where they photostatted the thing and they sent it. I got letters, but I also got these V-mails. They photostat was a. They could do it quicker that way, see? I think I'm right on that.
V-mail. Okay.
But yeah, well, it's... She was really good about writing, and my mom too. Yeah, we look forward to that, or the box, you know, salami and stuff in like that.
Yeah.
And
you made a lot of friends when you got packages like
that.
Oh yeah,
and vice versa. Yeah, of course. Yeah, you shared it, whatever you got.
When you left the military, did you use the GI Bill? Did you use any? Did you attend school after that, or?
My wife and I would have both been both qualified, but we wanted to get married at the time, and we were still reasonably young, and hindsight being what it is, yes, we could have both taken them and should have taken advantage of, but we didn't. But
you moved back to the Youngstown area, though, is that correct?
Yes, yes.
And
But I ended up in the automobile business, and I paid my own way to learn it. Okay.
Was it a dealership, or was it in a...
I worked in dealerships.
Okay.
Yeah. But I When I went first got back home, a real good friend of mine had a gas station, so I worked for him for like 2 years. Then I decided I'd get my own. But in the meantime, I'd been taking all these courses about automotive and stuff. And I paid for that myself. But and the instructor was really good, I will say that. But anyway, so I got my own gas station. I had a business for myself for 10 years.
Okay.
And Lois took care of the books. And it was at the repair shop also, as a combination type thing. And I made money there.
But did you have any experience beforehand on automobiles, or was that an interest when you were growing up, or was that just something you decided to go into?
I didn't know anything about cars when I grew up. Like my kids, both of them, they're experts on it, a hell of a lot better than I am. And they both have restored Mustangs. David has five of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Chip has two. No, I didn't know anything about that. But I just got in the military, being in the armored force, we brought a lot of equipment like that. And I guess that's where I got interested, maybe a little bit. But I did all right in business. I was in business for 10 years and I made money. But the bad part about it was my wife Lois raised our family. That's the bad part.
So you were spending a lot of time running that company.
I'd do it again, it'd probably be the same thing, I suppose, but c'est la vie, huh?
And then when did you decide to come down to Florida? Around when was that?
Our youngest, 1974.
Okay.
Our youngest son was going to the university, graduated from the university. And our other, oldest son, Chip, he had come down here about a year before. So they were both down here, and like I told you, they came up to visit us, and they said, well, we aren't going to come up anymore until you come down and see us. So mm-hmm. It was in the winter. That was a plus. It was in March, I think. But my mother was living with us at the time because my father had died, and she couldn't keep her house anymore. So she and Lois and I flew down here in 74. Went back and decided to sell our house and move down here. And I'd never been to Florida before. I spent 14 months in California, and I've been pretty much around, but never in Florida.
Yeah, I was wondering because I saw that the 128th was at one period stationed at Camp Blanding, and I thought maybe you had been associated with them when they were at Camp Blanding.
Are you sure they were Camp Blanding?
I think that the individual who wrote that listed Camp Blanding.
John Glasscock. Yeah. Well, it could be. I don't know that.
Maybe just briefly.
Well, you might be right. Yeah, okay. No, I wasn't. I'd never been to Florida previous to that. But don't forget, I didn't join them until, like I told you, until they were ready to almost go overseas.
And so you've been here in the Gainesville area since then?
Yes.
Okay.
However, we did go back up more than once and things like that. And, made trips all over Florida several times and up in Georgia and all that, everybody else.
And I guess just to finish things off, I just wanted to ask some general questions about your experiences. Looking back on it now, how do you think Americans remember World War II, and what do you think they should remember from it? Looking back on your experience, what should we look back at this as?
I think Americans now don't really appreciate what we did.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because of the time element. I mean, like I say, we were the greatest generation. I don't think we were the greatest generation. We weren't even the same generation.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't the same generation as Patton or General Groh, our division commander,
Mm-hmm.
And whoever was there, they'd have done the same thing we had to do. If you were there, you'd have to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just happened to be there, that's all. Today is not the United States I grew up in. And I think it's human nature. I mean, people aren't going to care about World War II or World War II veterans. That's passe, in my opinion. Do you remember the Civil War? No. When you think about it, right? Well, be the same thing in World War II. There'll probably be another war to worry about then, especially this jerk we got in Washington. I don't care who knows it. I'm talking about the president. That's my opinion, which I'm entitled to. Mm-hmm.
Well, did you have any final thoughts before we concluded the interview? That anything that I failed to bring up that you'd like to briefly mention? Or?
Well, if you read my thing, I told you all my, my opinions, the last paragraph that I wrote there, and that small one that I wrote. And I think it covers it. I mean, of course, I wasn't going to do any good on this audio tape, but I'd have to read it off to tell you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate it.